welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ben.
My name is Noel. Citizen Noel, that is.
Citizen Noel.
Yes.
Not a consumer.
Well, you know, I do consume quite a bit of things, but I like to think of myself more as a conscientious citizen of these here United States.
Mm-hmm. Noel and I, just for a peek behind the curtain, we have been in the studio for a while today, working on a couple of different projects, right?
Yeah, we have another show called Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. We just spent an hour and a half talking about John F. Kennedy, so we're both a little punchy, but hopefully that will translate into an entertaining episode of Ridiculous History.
That's right. That's our show. Mm-hmm. Here we are. Mm-hmm. So we've had a crazy time, you know, starting this show and looking at not just single historical episodes in isolation. We've been exploring the context in which these events occur.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. And one thing that I think fascinates both of us is how stuff that would seem on the surface really small has these universal, ubiquitous, and important implications.
Absolutely. And that is absolutely the case today with our topic of when and why did America start calling its citizens consumers?
Which is such a good question. And before you brought this to me, I had never thought about this. Like it just slid by my mind, and I was reading so many different stories, you know, news stories, essays, creative nonfiction, where people, pundits, experts, authors use these phrases interchangeably, which is kind of weird when you think about it, you know? So there was a recent opinion piece, that was published in a political newspaper called The Hill. And in this piece, which is titled How Trump's Immigration Plans Hurt American Citizens' Pocketbooks, the author, Maurice Goldman, criticized the Trump administration's plans for a crackdown on immigration by pointing to the cost of building the infamous border wall, the cost of hiring enforcement agents, the cost of reducing legal immigration channels. But of particular interest for our purposes today, Goldman used the phrase consumer in the body of the text. In the title, it's citizen, but he notes you, the consumer, will pay for, you know, the plans, the political plans, if this wall and stuff goes through.
And like you just said, I mean, is this an issue of semantics, or was this intentional? And the answer to that is pretty interesting. It's hard to say quite when this took place, but in the last handful of years, there has been an increasing tendency to use the term consumer interchangeably with citizen. Mm-hmm. And that's even when the conversation has to do with the economy.
Yeah. And again, it seems like on the surface a small thing, but political experts, growing numbers of political experts, are concerned with this. And they're arguing that the choice of words signals a shift in how we see ourselves as individuals participating in the United States, right? And what our role is in American society. So the people who are concerned are saying that this is moving the individual away from this idea of citizenship, working with others in collaboration towards some common greater good, right? And toward something else.
Yeah, something that's much more selfish and individualistic and based on the acquisition of things that can also be turned around and applied to ideas or the way our vote is almost equivalent to the way we spend money.
Exactly. And there's a professor named Jathan Sadowski.
Jathan?
Jathan.
You developed a lisp just now?
No, Jathan, like Nathan, but with a J.
Whoa.
I know.
I've never seen that one before.
I know. That's a new one. He argues that using the term consumer interchangeably with the term citizen has, quote, become part of our default discourse, the normal way we view society and people. And he says, just look at the recent presidential election. The consumer versus citizen language is often used with analysts and pundits talk about elections. And this goes to the point that Noel highlighted. Voters are just consumers with preferences, and the election is a marketplace of products to choose from.
To continue the quote, in the store, we vote with our dollar. We are told that elections are functionally the same thing. You just use a ballot instead of a buck to cast your vote. This understanding of democratic processes as a marketplace is just one more place where the citizen is overtaken by the consumer, end quote.
And both of these words have been around for centuries and centuries, right? The word citizen dates back to the 1300s. Originally, it meant the inhabitant of a city.
Yeah, the entry in the online etymology dictionary for citizen says, from sight, citizen of the world translates in Greek to cosmopolites.
Oh, that's cool. That's a good one. On the other side, the evolution of citizen to mean what we take it to mean today, a person who has both rights in a society and responsibilities to that society, that didn't come around until around 1610. The term consumer arose shortly after the original version of the term citizen.
I love the entry for that one in the online etymology dictionary. It says, quote, one who squanders or wastes, agent noun from consume in economic sense, one who uses up goods or articles, opposite of producer. And that dates back to 1745. Then it also says consumer goods is attested from 1890 in consumers for a representative basket of goods and services. And that actually is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yeah, so that's these are legit sources. And no one is saying that these words just suddenly emerged like in 1970 or whatever. Like many words in English, this is an evolving language, right? It's a living language. So like many other terms, the terms citizen and consumer have undergone evolution over the years. And the question is what these mean today, right? According to Michael Munger, who is the director of the Philosophy, Politics, and Economics program at Duke University's Political Science Department, the word consumer, although it existed, as we had said, for centuries, it didn't really appear in print until 1900.
Ben, have you ever done a Google Ingram search?
I only started because of this.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So you can actually like search for a combination of words, compare two words, and it'll track it over time as it appears in this, you know, vast online collection of books that Google has digitized. And starting in 1800 and going to the year 2000, this Ingram search tracks the use of citizen versus consumer. And this is in fractions of a percent. So starting in 1800, citizen is a clear winner with consumer very, very low, just like a tiny fleck above 0%. And then as time goes on, starting in around 1919 to be precise, there is a significant spike in citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And as this is going on, consumer is kind of rising. Then there's a crossover point in 1956, at which point consumer goes through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And ending in 2000, consumer well above citizen in terms of its use in literature.
Right. Yeah. And it's fascinating to see this laid out in an infographic form, because Noel is absolutely correct. You can see the direct correlation. You can see the switch point at which people, or writers, authors at least, started preferring the term consumer to the term citizen.
And now it's used about three times as often. Munger theorizes that this change in the usage had largely to do with the rise of progressive politics in the 20th century. And here's a quote from Munger, quote, the progressives primarily saw citizens as being helpless, trapped by large forces, especially corporations, that citizens couldn't deal with. And he attributes Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal social programs that came about in the 30s, as well as Lyndon Johnson's Great Society effort in the 60s, as reinforcing the idea that participation in politics was mostly a way to just get your share of the pie, you know, mm-hmm. get a piece.
Mm-hmm. So it's less of a civic duty. It's less of a what can I do for my country and more of a what can my country do for me.
Exactly.
And this increasing use of the term consumer doesn't just apply to people who are writing about politics. It applies to politicians themselves. And when we're talking about President Johnson's Great Society stuff in the 1960s, we are also examining the rise of some things that would surprise the average voter.
Marketing.
Right.
Marketing.
Yes, marketing, which means that we are going to take a little bit of a side trail into a man named Edward Bernays. And Edward Bernays, as you know, is a guy that you and I have spent a lot of time on in the past.
Yeah, he's sort of the big grandpappy of marketing and this idea of selling things to a mass audience, including various methods from billboards to magazine articles to later television. Think Mad Men, you know, the television show, the whole world that's depicted in that, the Madison Avenue ad agency universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for sellers of products like breakfast cereals and cars and antiperspirants, all of these modern things that everyone just had to have. And today, you know, we can micro-target people's preferences, you know, using these campaigns and this massive amounts of data that can be analyzed much, much, much more quickly than in the past. And now it looks at individual voters' attitudes and their corresponding behavior, and can kind of figure out what might be the best way to actually reach them in the same way as, you know, appealing to somebody about a particular type of microwave meal.
Right. And that in itself is important for us to note. That in itself is not inherently a bad thing. However, it is an important thing, and it is crucial that people be aware of what is happening.
So tell me a little bit about Bernays.
Oh, man, I'm so glad you asked. Okay, so Edward Bernays, get this, nephew of Sigmund Freud. True story.
Can't be a coincidence.
Can't be a coincidence, right? Edward Bernays took a lot of psychological concepts and said, well, how can we – I hesitate to use the word weaponize, but maybe apply is a better word. He said, how can we apply these concepts about how the workings of the human mind and translate them into – quantifiable, predictable, real-world results? How can we push people not only to make the decision we want them to make, but to make them feel that it is their decision, that they have agency in this choice? He has done so much stuff. So I really appreciate that you mentioned the concept of breakfast, right? So before Edward Bernays, the typical breakfast in the United States would be something like a cup of coffee and maybe a croissant or a
croissant.
A croissant.
Croissant?
Yes, yes. Or a bagel, couple pieces of toast, maybe some butter.
A bagel and toast? That's a lot of carbs, dude.
Yeah, you put the toast, it's a toast sandwich. So you get the bagel and you put the toast in between.
That doesn't sound very healthy. And that's actually kind of the point, because what ended up being foisted upon the American consumer was this idea of bacon for breakfast, right?
Yes, yeah. Edward Bernays, make no bones about it, is the reason that bacon became part of the American breakfast, because without getting too deep into it, here's what happened. In the 1920s, Edward Bernays was approached by a company called the Beech Nut Packing Company. They're the people who made beech nut gum at the time, right? Mm-hmm. But they did a lot of other stuff, and they had a lot of other concerns, and one of their big concerns was pork. Edward, they asked the guy, we need to increase demand.
We have all this trash meat laying around. You know, how do we, foist it on the American public?
Right, exactly. Just so. And he thought, well, we could do the typical sort of advertisement at the time where we could just have somebody be like, hey, I'm cool. I'm wearing a suit and get a nice tie and I like bacon. You should too. And that was, you know, that was the approach that advertising used. But he did something very different. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, let me conduct a quote unquote poll of doctors, of medical experts, and let me twist the questions in such a way that they will all end up agreeing or appearing to agree that bacon is not only good for you, but should be eaten by any person with half a concern about their health early in the morning and give them energy and it's substantial. And that's the thing. It worked. It not only did it work, but it continues to work today. Edward Bernays, who could be the subject of his own show, right? He went on to tie smoking tobacco with women's suffrage. He went on to help support propaganda pushing the American public, citizens or consumers, whatever you want to call them, into supporting a coup in South America. And he continues to influence things today. This is one of the correlations, one of the points at which people stopped thinking about the average voter as a citizen and started thinking about them as consumers.
Well, it's the way, you know, politicians have to essentially market themselves and dress up their platforms in such a way that appeals to different voting bases. And a lot of it is entirely based on rhetoric, which you could, you know, kind of equate to something like ad copy, mm-hmm. where it's like, sure, it's technically true and it's backed up by science or like, you know, facts. But at the end of the day, it's this like packaged, curated version of the truth. Mm-hmm. And that is the way things are today. And the government itself, in fact, is actually judged as if it were a business, a consumer business. The American Customer Satisfaction Index actually rates the federal government on how people feel about their interactions with it, how they feel. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So there's Bernays at work right now. And it actually got a 68% positive rating in 2016, which was up from 63.9% the previous year. So I'd be interested to know how that ranks today.
Yeah, and the methodology behind it. People who have a problem with this interchangeable use of citizen and consumer, they argue that there are fundamental differences between the two roles in society and that they should not be confused. So how about this? I want to outline some of these proposed differences and see what you think.
Sure.
Okay. So is there an issue of morality? You know, earlier we mentioned the concept of doing stuff for other people for the greater good versus doing something for one's self. So one of the proposed differences would be that the job of any consumer is to always choose what works best for them in the marketplace, regardless of any other considerations.
Totally.
Right?
And that's what I do.
I think that's also the human condition, though, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, but that therein lies the issue with this whole notion of like being pulled away from the idea of being part of a whole or being a member of a team and going to a much more self-serving attitude that's kind of codified and bolstered by the use of these words and the distinctions that they sort of imply, I guess, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then, if a by this understanding, if this difference is true, then by virtue of voting, a consumer is saying, what will make me better directly now? Whereas a citizen would be saying, what can I do to improve the world?
Yeah, conditions for everyone, for my neighbors.
Yeah, yeah, like a rising tide carries all vessels.
Totally.
And a good citizen then would be, in their own way, kind of heroic or very moral. That's what it sounds like, mm-hmm. right? And a good consumer would be getting the best deal. There's another difference, which is that citizens are comfortable with a degree of uncertainty. I'm doing my best to help the group, the community, the nation, etc. I'm not sure how it's going to work out, but I know my intentions are what I believe to be good. Whereas a consumer says, you know, if I'm paying for this service, whether that's through time, whether that's through money, whether that's through exchange of materials, then I need to be certain that this transaction occurs, you know? So with this idea, there's this implication that a citizen knows that society has what HR departments around the world call areas of opportunity.
God.
You remember that one?
I do. You know how much I love these corporate terms.
Yes, yes.
Synergy?
Synergy.
Is there synergy?
Mm-hmm. And cadence.
Gosh.
That's a new one making the rounds. Well, the idea holds up, though, because the concept then would be that you and I and everyone who has a vote understands that we can play a part in improving society in whatever way we think it should be improved, right? And that these problems will not be fixed themselves. And then on the other side, the concept of a consumer would be that someone expects to purchase essentially a product or a service, and that the people providing that product or service, it's on them to fix stuff, right? So I voted for you. Just do the thing. You know what I mean? And we know that this is a very, very contentious thing.
Well, let's go through a little bit, since this is a ridiculous history.
Yeah.
Let's just talk a little bit about the history of the idea of humans as consumers. There's a fantastic article by Frank Trentman in The Atlantic that has a couple of great quotes from the famous American thinker Adam Smith, one of which is, consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production, which was from his treatise, I guess you could call it, The Wealth of Nations from 1776. That's a pretty famous quote. A lesser known quote from him that really sums up this whole idea comes from 1759's The Theory of Moral Sentiments, where he kind of really hones in on the, as Trentman puts it, the social and psychological impulses that cause us to want to get a bunch of stuff, little knickknacks, paddywhacks,
tchotchkes,
gadgets. And this quote, again from Smith, does a really good job of summing all that up. He observed that people wanted to, quote, stuff their pockets with little conveniences and then buying coats with more pockets to carry even more. By themselves, tweezer cases, elaborate snuff boxes, and other baubles might not have much use. But, Smith pointed out, what mattered was that people looked at them as means of happiness. And he goes on to say that it was in people's imaginations that these objects became part of a harmonious system and made the pleasures of wealth grand and beautiful and noble. And even, you know, ancient Greek thinkers, philosophers from, you know, Plato to St. Augustine, they kind of condemned the pursuit of stuff as being inherently wicked and mm-hmm. self-serving. So there is this history of the idea of being a citizen as being much more important. And if it feels like throughout history, obviously there is that selfish impulse. But as a whole, civilization and societies have largely maintained because of this notion of, you know, the whole is more important than the individual parts, and that we're all banding together to make a better life for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And this leads us to something, a pretty interesting theory that you've probably heard of, which is the tragedy of the commons. And the tragedy of the commons is this economic theory that says if you're in a shared resource system, right? So you're in a community where everybody has like a common good. Let's mm-hmm. call it water, air, 1979 LPs. Who knows? Just like it's something for the people, mm-hmm. the way that you and I typically order fries when we hang out.
We do. Boiled peanuts, sure.
Yeah. The idea is that when individual users are acting independently according to their own self-interest, they will tend to behave in ways that deplete or spoil those common resources mm-hmm. because everybody wants their piece of the pie and would prefer not to have to help create the pie, right? And obviously, so many people have argued complex ideological questions based on how to address this dilemma of individuals trying to improve society, to take a line from the Simpsons, to embiggen society, or to improve themselves, even if such a thing might have dangerous consequences, right, or unforeseen consequences down the road. And it might sound, folks, as if Noel and I are dwelling on semantics, but we are not, because it turns out that science backs this up. In a 2012 study in the journal Psychological Science, they found that choice of words can exert a subtle influence upon how we see ourselves, which then, you know, naturally influences how we behave. So in one part of the study, people who answered a, quote, consumer response survey tended to express more materialistic, self-centered values. People who did a survey that was called a citizen survey tended to behave in a more a less selfish way.
Yeah, and another part of the same survey, the researchers looked at subjects with – gave them a hypothetical situation where people had to join together and share water from a well, and they were labeled as either consumers or citizens. And the members of the study that got the consumer label tended to be completely distrustful of their cohorts and just didn't want to share the water. They just were a little crotchety about it, and they did not feel as though they were on a team or in partnership with the other subjects, and just felt overall less tied to or responsible for the experience and, you know, well-being, honestly, of their compatriots, as opposed to those who were labeled citizens who felt just the opposite.
Right, right. And now we if we are called one name or another, it tends to affect our behavior. Now we see this article by Maurice Goldman becomes even more important. I don't want to say insidious, but I do want to say important. Because, you know, on some level, it might feel, I don't know, condescending or diminutive to say, oh, you are not so smart, right? You are easily influenced. Right. If somebody calls me a name, that shouldn't influence my behavior already. But apparently it does. Apparently we are a little bit easier to steer than we would like to think. And this goes back to the Bernays thing, right? The idea of a citizen versus a consumer in terms of active versus passive roles.
Did you know that the I'm sure you've heard the use of the term consumption to refer to tuberculosis?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, it was definitely had very, very negative connotations. I'm going back to the Atlantic article from Frank Trettman. He has a section where he talks about some of the history of the term consumption and the, as he calls it, the heavy burden that it carried, and that it was originally from the term, the Latin term consumere, which first presented itself in French in the 12th century and then into English and other European languages later. And of course, it meant, as I said with the etymological origins earlier, mm-hmm. using up, wasting kind of implied of food or any other consumables, I guess, yeah. for lack of a better term.
Yeah, yeah.
But like I said, the idea of tuberculosis or wasting disease being called consumption because it had this inherently like mm-hmm. it just eats you up. And that was very much a sign of being irresponsible and not looking out for the greater good of your community or family, what have you.
Not being a good citizen. And we would be remiss if we didn't just mention for a second everyone's favorite fictional consumptive, which is Val Kilmer playing Doc Holliday in Tombstone.
Bloody rack.
Yeah. Oh, man.
What does he say? Who's Huckleberry?
I'm your Huckleberry.
Oh, you're my Huckleberry. Ben? Thanks. Bromance for the ages.
Bromance for the ages. And history for the pages, which rhymes but doesn't really make sense if you think about it. So Josh Pasek is an assistant professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. And he draws some conclusions based on this shift. And he says it seems to underscore a shift away from viewing Americans as having responsibility in our political system and toward a more individualist view of what it means to be American. So in his mind, the role of a citizen is more active and the role of a consumer is more passive. And in his mind, these are two different things, right? They're not synonyms. He says your job as an American citizen requires that you fulfill key democratic norms, such as being informed, deliberating about political issues, and participating in civic and political life. As an American consumer, he says, your actions are relevant only to the extent that they respond to economic incentives. The responsibility to be engaged and participatory is not your own, but instead depends upon a system that is oriented to bring you in.
Unpack that for us, Ben.
Okay, sure. I would love to. So again, the idea of citizenship as a responsibility, right? Like if you're a citizen, you're not just supposed to show up and vote. You are supposed to put some research time into it, right? And be aware. And, you know, not for nothing, it's true that most people don't know their congressional district.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm being honest, I voted the other day and there were a whole lot of names on the ballot that I was not 100% familiar with. There were some races that I'd followed very closely and I knew what I was signing up for. But, you know, it's very difficult to be completely informed about every aspect of the political process. But I guess what the takeaway here is that, you know, just you got to try to do your homework and consider beyond just, you know, your personal stake, what might be good for your entire community. Because, you know, with names I didn't recognize on the ballot, if I had voted for somebody just out of sheer, you know, randomness, what if I accidentally voted for a monster or voted to keep an incumbent in power that had done bad things for the community and then needed to be replaced, you know? So if I had gone in with that consumer mentality about what's good for me, you know, And maybe I'm guilty of that in a certain sense, I would only know what directly impacted me. Whereas if I had gone in with much more of a, you know, citizen, good citizen attitude, then maybe I would have thought about more what would affect areas that don't even affect me directly.
Right. You know, it's a dilemma. And we are talking about the influence of behavior. We want to be very clear that we're not a show that's going to like lecture people about politics.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not.
For us, this is a dilemma though.
It's a dilemma and it's kind of a thought experiment too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to say it, because the question then becomes, you know, is one, somehow better than the other, or are they just different? I would say that they're different. I would say that, everybody has played the part of a citizen. Everybody's played the part of a consumer. At the same time, you know, you're not going into Arby's, for instance, who is not a sponsor of the show. I'm just thinking like different is good.
Are they still around?
Yeah, they're still around.
I'm kidding. Those funny commercials.
But like, you know, nobody's walking into Arby's and saying, you know, at the soda fountain or at the little ketchup stand, no one's saying like, what can I do to make this ketchup stand better for everyone who comes after me?
Yeah. And, you know, speaking to Pasek's quote about, you know, as an American consumer, your actions are relevant only to the extent they respond to economic incentives, meaning, and sometimes those incentives are just personal fulfillment and, you know, pleasure. And your job, not to restate what you already said, Ben, but your job as an American citizen requires you to fulfill key democratic norms, such as being informed and deliberating about political issues. So the idea that there is this gray area or this kind of like fusion between the notion of a citizen and a consumer is potentially problematic for people making choices in elections that actually help others or that affect the greater good. If everyone's just voting for, you know, what will do good for themselves, and that also plays into how politicians market themselves, you know?
Right, right. The same techniques that Edward Bernays pioneered are now present not only in advertising, but are present in a very real way in the political sphere. I got to tell you, man, did you ever watch C-SPAN?
I mean, if there's something really crucial on, but no, I don't just watch it like my grandpapa used to though.
Yeah, I used to watch C-SPAN with my grandmother as well. When Golden Girls wasn't on, she loved Golden Girls, Hee Haw, and C-SPAN. Beautiful woman.
Yeah, it seems like a good mix.
One of the things that got me was years ago, we were watching C-SPAN at her house, and a congressperson was referring to a bill they were trying to pass as a product. Then they said, we're going to get this product out at the end of this time frame, and this product is going to, you know, be great for companies, all interested parties, stakeholders. And I didn't understand the term because why would you call something like that a product?
You're selling it.
Yeah.
You're selling it to your constituents. And this guy, Frank Trittman, who wrote the article from The Atlantic that I was talking about a little bit, is a professor of history at the University of London. And he wrote a fantastic book called Empire of Things, How We Became a World of Consumers from the 15th century to the 21st. And he thinks that the blurred distinction between these two cohorts, which ultimately have become kind of the same thing, consumer and citizen, make it really hard for people to come together to solve problems, which is essentially what I was trying to get at, what we're both trying to get at, Ben. And this quote, I think, really sums it all up nicely. Quote, not all consumers see the world in the same way, and hence concerted action is very difficult. That's what I was trying to get at, where, you know, when you have a politician that's marketing themselves to a particular voter base and the desires of that voter base are kind of a conflagration of like different sort of self-serving desire. So it's very difficult to like pick out a platform or a thing or like to appeal to all of these different, you know, angles and get elected kind of requires some weird backwards logic and convoluted thinking, you know?
Especially when so many of those interests might be contradictory.
Exactly.
Right?
So, and here we are, 2017.
here we are, but history doesn't stop here. I have to wonder, Noel, what future historians will make of this shift, which, again, occurred without my knowledge at all. Like, I did not notice, other than my spider sense tingling when I heard things, laws referred to as products. This totally whooshed over my head, man. I don't know.
It's a little insidious though, right? It kind of happens. It just sort of kind of creeps in, you know, without you even realizing it.
So are we citizens or are we consumers?
I think it's a choice we have to make. I mean, obviously we're consumers when it comes to like, you know, I like buying stuff. I like, you know, nice clothes and things like that. But when you start integrating that into the political process and how you vote as though it were spending money and as though you're being marketed to, that's problematic, I think. And it's an interesting shift in history. And it's more than a little ridiculous.
It is. It is more than a bit ridiculous. We hope that you find this dilemma or this interesting differentiation as fascinating as we do, and we'd like to hear your thoughts. So please write into us and let us know if you think this is a big deal, if you think this is just relatively small matter of semantics, and most importantly, let us know if you have found other linguistic shifts in your own experience, and let us know what you think the implications of those might be. You can write to Noel and I at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. But that's not all. You can find us on the internet too.
Yeah, we're on the social media. We've got a Facebook page, Ridiculous History. Just Google that and give us a like. And also, if you dig the show, please check us out on iTunes and write us a nice review. That helps kind of boost the show and the algorithm and all that. And hopefully more people can discover it. Yeah, because we like doing the show and we'd like to continue doing it. So thanks for joining us for this episode. And we hope to see you next time on Ridiculous History.